Thank you for tuning in to the Essential Church Podcast, a church where we focus on restoration over denomination. If you're in the Virginia Beach area and would like to find out more about Essential Church, visit our webpage at essentialchurch.com.
Cool story when you look at it. Now, all you judgmental people in the room, how many of y'all were looking at that story and about halfway through you thought to yourself, what about the other guy? So you're laughing because that's what you were thinking. And that kind of gets to our topic this morning of how to be an influence in the world. See, because I left off last week and was talking about how everybody wants to change the world, but nobody wants to help mom with the dishes. And there's something, I don't know what it is. I can only conclude after looking at everything I looked at for this week for this message is that our desire to change the world is put there by God. I mean, it's something he's hardwired into every one of us. I mean, even people who aren't connected with God, if you ask them what do they think life is all about outside of a connection with God, people continue to say, to make the world a better place. I just want to do something to improve and help the world. And you say, where does that come from? When we come back to the end of this, I'm going to come back and show you. I believe that's put there by God because Jesus is the one who changes the world. And God puts a desire within us to change the world, and the only way that that can happen is to the extent to which Jesus is in us. Okay, that's the entire message right there. You got it. If you got somewhere to go, you got it, and you're okay. But the thing is the world will not be changed because we teach people Jesus. The world will be changed because we live Jesus among them. In the same way that somebody doesn't lose weight because you buy them a gym membership, that guy lost weight because he needed a gym partner. Did you catch that? Along the way, it said Team Zaxby's who walked him through this process. I think the owner of the restaurant bought him the membership, but then the manager became his nutritionist, and the guys who worked with him became his workout partners. And that's how the change happened. It wasn't because everybody, like you in the room, looked at them and said, that guy needs to lose weight. Thank you, Mr. Obvious. He didn't need that. I think he probably heard that message all his life. When you're 600 pounds, I have a friend of mine who's in that range. You have no shortage of people who feel like they need to point that out to you, like as if you couldn't figure that out on your own somehow. Like they've got to point out to you, hey, this is a problem for you. And he said, you know, the hard thing about having weight, having eating, overeating being your vice and having weight being your issue is everybody knows what my sin is. Everybody knows what my issue is. The rest of y'all get the luxury of hiding it, and only a few people sometimes figure it out. But as obvious as mine is to the entire world, there are some people who still feel the need to point it out every time they see me. And once again, what he doesn't need, and what the guy in the Zaxby's thing doesn't need somebody pointing it out, rather needs somebody who will be his gym partner. They don't need somebody to just teach them about Jesus. They need somebody to be Jesus among them because he is the change agent in the world. And when you see when Jesus came on the scene, you know, we've been looking at this series, by the way, to give you the kind of the overview as the it factors. What was it about Jesus that made him so unique? What was it about Jesus that drew people to him? And in the series, we looked at different things about how he showed people honor and that you can go back over the history and look at it, but don't have enough time to go into it right now. Bottom line, one of the amazing things about Jesus was the influence that he had. And part of this came about with the kind of person he was and the style in which he had. In this day and age, the religious leaders, they're leadership method and influence message was simply to point out, which, by the way, is very similar to the way the church does things today. But there's this profound way that John begins his telling of Jesus, his telling of the Jesus story. He says in John 1:14, he says that the Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. In other words, he says God came down in the form of Jesus and made his dwelling among us. Among us. Now, we read that, we just kind of go, okay, tell me what happened when he came among us. But there was something very unique about that, especially in the day and time. You see, the religious leadership in that time, one of the main groups was called the Pharisees. You've maybe heard the term. Many people don't know what the word Pharisee means, though. It means simply the separated ones. The separated ones. Now, think about, in contrast, John begins his gospel saying, I know when you think of religious leaders, you think of the separated ones, but this is the one who came from God, who was God, who was not the separated one. He was the one who was among us. And when it comes to separated ones, that literally came from the idea that the Pharisees felt they needed to be separated from the mass of humanity. Because remember, we looked last week how many people in that day and age thought the second most important thing behind loving God, the second most important thing was to keep yourself holy. And if I'm going to keep myself holy, I've got to separate myself from the rest of you who don't keep yourself holy. I'm saying that right now. I need to keep myself separate from the rest of you. If I'm going to keep myself holy, I can't hang out with y'all, right? Because y'all are just too messed up, too jacked up. I read your Facebook posts, and I just got to separate myself from people who live like you. That was the mindset in that day and age. And that even still spills over today, what they call second-degree separation. Anybody familiar with second-degree separation? It can be best summarized with the old statement, I don't drink, smoke, dance, or chew, and don't hang out with those who do. You see, I got to separate myself from the painful influences. And not only am I going to separate myself from those influences, I'm going to separate myself from anybody who doesn't separate themselves from those influences. It's called second degree separation. And that's what the Pharisees were all about. It was even said that they despised the mass of their own countrymen as, here's the quote from this historian, the brute people of the earth. Those utterlings, those sinfulness people. And they didn't want anything to do with them. And in the midst of that, John says, what was so amazing about Jesus is that he came and he lived among us. He wasn't separated from us, but he was among us. And if you see the way that he interacted with people, he was among them. One of the stories I go back to is in Matthew 11, where Matthew is sort of telling his story of how he met Jesus. Now, Matthew was a tax collector. That doesn't mean a whole lot to us except for in April. But in that day and time, tax collectors were, there was like kind of levels of sinners. You had, of course, the elite, those were the religious, the Pharisees, the separated ones who were separated from anybody who didn't separate themselves. Then there was the people who tried to separate themselves from the harmful influences, the very religious and devout. Then you had kind of the mass of religious following, good practicing Jews. And then below that, you had categories of people who weren't allowed in the synagogue, but they were still okay people. Those were like the shepherds. And then below that were this class of sinners, like prostitutes and others who just lived themselves in a sinful life. And below that, the lowest of the low, below the lowest of the low, was this group called tax collectors, and that's who Matthew was. And so it's very notable that Jesus not only would associate with him, but invite him to be one of his close followers. And when Jesus first comes up to him in Matthew chapter 9 and invites him to be a part of his inner circle, Matthew says, before I follow you, can you come follow me to my house and have a party with me? Because I want to connect you to all my friends. Now, that would be unheard of for a rabbi, or especially someone who is trying to be separated from. And what you see, follow is that Matthew throws a party with all of his lowest of the low scoundrels. Some even actually, some modern translations refer to them as scum, just the best way you, I mean, that's how they were reviewed. And Jesus went and hung out with them. And when he did, of course, the religious elite comes around and says, what's your rabbi doing hanging out with those kind of people? And if you remember, I taught a message about this a while back, was the tax collectors and sinners. You know, that's kind of how they, anybody remember that? Some of y'all remember that. That's how they referred to what he was doing. And because their mindset, their thought process on how God wanted to impact change was heavily influenced by Selena Gomez, I believe, who would just simply say, when you're ready, come and get it. No. That's really was their philosophy. When you're ready, you can come get it. When you're ready to live like God and be holy and change the way you're living, then you can come and get some Jesus, or then you can come and get some God in your life. That was their philosophy. And that philosophy continues even to this day. That's why you hear people say, I'm just not good enough yet to go to church. I got to change the way. I can't be there. I would just be judged. And where does that come from? It comes from centuries of the church following after the Pharisaical separate ones rather than the Jesus who was among them. Because somehow in our mindset, we've done everything we can to separate ourselves. And I get this problem of being separate yet being among didn't just start in Jesus' time. I want to give you a quick biblical overview. I shouldn't even get into this, but I just can't resist myself sometimes. A lot of times you've heard this taught, the Jews were God's chosen people. And the problem is the way that we interpret that is painted by the dysfunctional theology of the Jews themselves from back in the day, okay? They were never meant to be the chosen ones as though they were this special race and group of people that God loves and he doesn't love everybody else. That's how they interpret it. That's how they lived it out. Simply what you read through is God says, I want to have a relationship with all of humanity, and so I got to start somewhere. I'm going to start with this guy, Abraham. And so it says, Abraham, through you, I'm going to bless the entire world. That was the vision. And they took it as, Abraham, through you, I'm going to bless just the people who are in your family. And here's the way that happened. What happened is that as they moved on, they were supposed to be an influence to the world, but they could never get, his descendants never seemed to be able to get themselves right with God. And because they could never get themselves right with God, because they could never get enough God in their life, they continually needed to fend off the outside world. And this kind of goes through in the days of Moses. The people are in slavery. They come into the promised land, and God says, all right, clear out the promised land. In other words, purify yourselves and purify the land, so now you can be a beacon of light to the entire world. They never did that. They never got themselves so focused on God that they could be a blessing to anybody else. Rather, they just let the world continue to influence them and influence them and influence them. And the more that they were being influenced by everybody else, the more people said, we got to not be influenced by everybody else. And they were fighting that battle, that prime battle of just being sold out to God, so much so that that defined who they were as a people. And the only thing they could do is build up walls and try to keep people out, because they could never get to the point where they were sold out for God and being influenced for others. And that same mindset continues all the way down to the Pharisees, who need to be the separated ones. In the midst of that, Jesus comes in the middle of it and says, no, if you have God in you, you will be an influence to the entire world. And the difference, of course, comes in as this issue we talk about around here, at least in our staff meetings, and we're trying to spread this idea to the rest of the church. We talk about it in terms of this. Are you going to be a thermostat or a thermometer? You know, a thermometer reflects the climate and the mood and the temperature of the room. A thermometer reflects the morality of the room. If everybody else is doing it, I do it. If everybody else goes along with it, I go along with it. That's what a thermometer is. Reflects what the mood and the temperature of the room is. But a thermostat is what sets the mood and the temperature of the room. And that's how Jesus was unique. See, the Pharisees looked at it and says, if you hang out with those people, you're going to become like them. Because people are nothing more than thermometers. And they had no idea, no concept that the power of God living in through a person, especially one like Jesus, who was fully God, would be a thermostat in any room he came into. He would change the mood and the climate, and people would begin to follow after him, and people would become more like God because of his presence, rather than him becoming more like the people who are godless. And so that's why they come in. They say, why is this guy hanging out with all these sinners? And they even go on two chapters later, and they say of him, yeah, here's this Jesus who's a glutton and a drunkard. He's a friend of tax collectors and sinners. Because their mindset, without even examining his life and who he was, they just assumed if you're hanging out with that crowd, you're going to become like that crowd, rather than him being such an influence in that crowd that a guy like Matthew would become such a follower of God and so much like Christ, he ends up writing a biography about Christ that we're quoting and reading from right now. This is a man who is radically changed to be a different person. A guy like Zacchaeus, who is radically changed to become like Christ. Those are the kind of people Jesus hung out with, and he was a thermostat in their life who changed the moral temperature and who they were and how they viewed God, rather than him being influenced by the world. And so he continually went out there, and that's why he says back to the people, says, listen, it's not the healthy you need a doctor, but the sick. That's what he says to the Pharisees. They say, why are you hanging out there? Because you've got to be, you're not gonna enact change in the world just hanging out within. And where this kind of comes in our day and age is that we keep throwing out the stat every single week. 7 out of 10 people in our city aren't connected to church. And part of that is the church's fault. I'm saying church as a whole. And since we are a church, we have to be in somewhat extent a part of that. And that's because in the Christian community, we still do this kind of thing where we separate ourselves. We have what's called the Christian bubble that is very easy to sort of get sucked into. We have our own movies and we have our own radio station. And we have, you know, instead of getting on Facebook, we can get on Godbook. And Facebook? Yeah, instead of Facebook, they actually have Facebook. Instead of YouTube, we have got GodTube. We can create our own little Christian bubble and world where we never have to venture out and interact with people. And as a pastor, I tell you, it's harder for me than it is anybody else, because I work with Christians, and most people who I interact with socially are all you people. I don't get the great privilege of going out into the world and working a job where I'm going to be inundated with people who are nothing like Christ, which is an amazing blessing for you, which is why I'm jealous of you. I'm jealous of the access that you have to go out into the world and to reach people. That's why, for me, I try to do those things. I haven't in a while since our church has grown, but I used to work at Buffalo Wild Wings, not like work in the kitchen, but I would do my church work at Buffalo Wild Wings simply so I could be there and meet people who didn't go to church. And I always am trying to find those places. And it seems like everywhere I go, I suck church people in with me, and then I got to find a new place. I started playing soccer, and I was the only guy on my team. It was great because it led this girl to Christ, and she started following Christ and started to influence her family to do the same, which is really neat. And every once in a while, she'll send me this text about walking in Christ, and it's just this really neat whole relationship. But then pretty soon, all of a sudden, now we have a church soccer team. So, like, all the Christians followed me and messed it up. So I'm not really sure what to do now. But one thing we have done as a church team is we've made sure that, like, a certain percentage of our team does not go to church. Now, they get us in trouble. We've had more red cards and more people thrown out of the league for fighting and cussing than any other team in the league. And here's the thing. The Christians in the league who are not playing for Christian teams write me hate email how can somebody representing your church live like this? And I try to write him back and say, listen, this person doesn't go to church, but it's exactly the kind of person that we need to be influencing and being a part of. And my wish and my dream and my hope is that the rest of the Christians in the league would see that that's what a church ought to be. The church is not supposed to be a bubble, but they view us as a bubble and they think to themselves, wait, you guys are supposed to be a bubble. You guys are supposed to all be Christians. You're supposed to be separate. You're supposed to act differently. And I'm like, no, we're supposed to be in the world. And what the church should be is this group of tax collectors and sinners and messed up, jacked up people who are trying to influence and try to move to become more like Christ because we want to have an influence in this guy. I think the person who should be the most violent and the most language cussed filled person in the whole league ought to be on this team. It's exactly where God wants that person to be. And yeah, it may mess up our testimony amongst all the other Christians, but you know, the rest of the world just doesn't get what it is that Christ is trying to do. And for those of you on that team, Emmanuel is the Lord's name. And he's also a guy who was on our soccer team, got kicked out of the league, and he's coming back, and I'm going to make him on our team again. Because my hope is that we can continue to be an influence on him. And if we're going to have a church team, I don't want it to be another little bubble on that field. I just don't. But that's my own rant on the side. It's very easy for us to continue to close ourselves off and make all of our peer groups and social groups here a part of that. But we say this, you need to join a small group so you can have that, but you also need to be a part of a service team. And a service team is where you serve people who aren't you're not serving your peer group in the service team. You're serving anybody who walks through these doors, and you're becoming Jesus to them. And many of you are also on service teams that serve outside of these walls in pen ministry and over in a food pantry. And they come back with these stories of people we're working with there don't act like Christians. And it's like, yeah, because they're not. And I always love, there's a line in Braveheart which says, the problem with Scots is they're Scots. And the thing about when we play softball in a non-church league, sometimes people gripe and say, they're not, they're mean. I'm like, yeah, they're acting like non-Christians. And we're to be a light in this world. We're supposed to be an influence in this world. And in that day and time, the religious people just sat back and pointed fingers. And Jesus got in amongst them and was Christ before them. And the amazing thing is that the impact that he had simply because of who he was. And like I said at the very beginning, the impact that we will have in the world, the level to the extent at which we become a thermostat in the world versus a thermometer is to the extent at which Christ is in you. Because he is the influence. And God is influencing the world through his son, Jesus Christ. And if you want to have an influence in the world and be an influence in the world, then you need to become more and more connected to him. Here's what I mean by this. If you look at the impact of history and anybody who's had a lasting impact on history, there is one man that stands along among everybody else, and that is Jesus Christ. If you were to go and try to gauge the impact that somebody's had on the world and do it at their death, he would probably finish dead last. I mean, certainly those of Alexander the Great and the fame in which they had coming up to their death would probably be at the top of the list of the most famous people in the world at their death, whereas Jesus at his death, if you go to the day of his death, would have died in obscurity, crushed by the Roman Empire. Yet, if history is really looking at impact by what they started and the impact that it's had and how it has grown and how it has influenced human thought throughout history, there is one man who stands alone in all of human history, and that is the man of Jesus Christ. So much so that when Time Magazine, who is known for doing Person of the Year, Person of the Year, Person of the Year, they've also done Person of the Century. When they came to the year 2000, they wanted to do Person of the Century, and they also wanted to do Person of the Millennium. And so they were taking submissions at large. Anybody could write in anybody for Person of the Millennium. Well, as they moved closer into November, December, they had to disqualify Jesus, because it just wasn't fair to include him in Person of the Millennium for obvious reasons. And so they told everybody he is disqualified from the contest because against him, everybody pales in comparison. So what they did is they actually came out with a two-part special on Jesus in December of 1999 because it just wasn't fair to include him amongst Person of the Millennium against anybody else, which I thought was hilarious, amazing, and so accurate. And they wrote this. Oh, tell me I didn't lose it. Ah, that's the problem. Sometimes you think, did I lose it? Nope. I'm about to lose it because I just hit that back button. Here we go. Sorry. Pay no attention to my hand motions. All right. The cover story article began this way. Now remember, this is Time Magazine. This is not Christianity Today. This is not a Bible journal. This is that bastion of conservative thought, Time Magazine. It says, the memory of any stretch of years eventually resolves a list of names. And one of the useful ways of recalling the past two millenniums is by listing the people who acquired great power, such as Muhammad, Catherine of the Great, Marx. I was about to say the Marx brothers, different. But Karl Marx, Gandhi, Hitler, Roosevelt, Stalin, and Mao. All of these names quickly come to mind. There's no question that each of these figures have changed the lives of millions and evoked responses ranging from worship to hatred. It would require, though, much exotic calculation, however, to deny that the single most powerful figure, not merely in these two millenniums, but in all of human history, has been Jesus of Nazareth. This is Time magazine, by the way. I got to reiterate that. Not only is the prevalent system of denoting the years based on his birth, but a serious argument can be made that no one else's life in history has remotely proved as powerful and as enduring as that of Jesus. It's an astonishing conclusion in light of the fact that Jesus was a man who lived a relatively short life in a rural backwater part of the Roman Empire and died in agony, convicted as a criminal. And then it goes on to talk about this amazing man and the influence he's had upon our times. And you think about Jesus, it's true. I mean, you know, he dies in obscurity, and then within a few hundred years after his death, the message of everything that he shared and taught begins to be spread throughout the world. It's one of the only pieces of literature that has survived the Dark Ages around the world. I mean, that was that time where nothing was recorded. Nothing seemed to escape that time from 500 AD to about 1500 AD. And it was only the message of Christ that seemed to emerge in literature from that time and from art. And then from the 1500s on, it spread throughout Europe and Northern Europe, and then over here to the Americas, and then from the Americas to South America, and then on into the East. And now the largest churches and the greatest populations of Christianity, believe it or not, are not in America anymore. They're down in South America and over into areas like Korea. And one author even said, it seems as though the more money and traction that that Jesus has within society, the more likely Christianity is to spread to some other place where it has less money and is more persecuted, which is unlike anything else in the world. And you look at the fields of influence that Jesus has had, there is no comparison when you look at his impact on art and on science and on education, on medicine, on astronomy. Everything traces its back and its origin back to him. Great men have sought to secure their immorality by naming cities after them and places after them, such as Alexandria being named for Alexander the Great and Caesarea being named after Julius Caesar. Yet Jesus never sought to name anything after him, yet it's hard to travel anywhere, especially in our country, without seeing some place denoted by somebody who was either a follower of him or named after something that he did, a place like Sacramento, which was named after a meal that he had known as the Sacrament. And how many saints and losses are, or Los Angeles and Saint this, that, and Saint that, and San Jose, how many things are named after something connected to Christ in our day and time, and all done because of the influence that he had upon humanity. When it comes to the calendar, many regimes have sought to date things in relation to their reign, and this was very popular in the Roman Empire, that they would date things by who was in charge and who was leading during that time. The French Revolution sought to rename time to begin with itself. Even as recently as Russia tried to redo the calendar to mark the end of the reign of the Caesars. Secular history has now tried to erase B.C. from the history books and call it now B.C.E. They would call, instead of saying it's before Christ, they say it's before the Common Era. And then instead of saying A.D., being, you know, in the year of our Lord, they try to now call it the Common Era. And I always go back, who are you fooling yourself? Who's the dividing line of the Common Era? Jesus himself. As the Russian leader back in our last century said, the more we have tried to get rid of Christianity and its influence on our time, we have found that Christianity is like a nail. The harder you strike at it, the deeper it goes into the soul of humanity. And you look at Christianity and Jesus, he never sought and his followers never sought for time to be named after him. As a matter of fact, they based him in the way that time was said of them. Luke begins his gospel account, his biography of Jesus, saying, in the 15th year of Tiberius Caesar, when Pontius Pilate was was the governor of Judea, and Herod was a tetrarch of Galilee, and so on and so forth. It's all based in that time, yet time is now based on who this figure was. It is hard to deny his impact on all of us. When you look at what people try to do to get themselves remembered and the influence they have is they want to name people after them. Herod the Great, his descendants were named Herod. There was another woman named Herodias, and they all sought to be somehow connected to him. Yet you look throughout time in human history, although we may look to the Hispanic culture and say it's Jesus, it still comes out as Jesus when you look at it on the player lineup and some sort of thing. And then if you add to that every other name that has become a popular name amongst our children, even to this day, how many of them are because they were followers or people who were connected somehow to Christ or his ministry here on earth? I think Mary was the number one name for many, 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 many years. And you go over to John being the number one name for many, 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 many years. Why? Because it was the mother and the best friend of Jesus. And so much of human history has been influenced by him. When it goes to art, the most amazing thing about Jesus is nobody knows what he looks like. We don't have a picture of him. He never sat for a portrait yet. Somewhere around the 400s, he was such a popular figure in art that they picture an image of Jesus. Although we don't really know what he looked like, the image that emerged from the 400s period is now the most recognizable face anywhere in the world. Whether you make him look Asian, or you make him look black, or you make him look any nationality you want, people still recognize it as Jesus. There is a black Jesus, an Asian Jesus, there's the white Jesus, there's the Aryan race Jesus, there's all of them, yet everybody looks back and says, that is unmistakably Jesus. He's the most recognizable figure in all of art. When it comes to teaching, the amazing thing is that most leaders try to have books written about them or write books themselves or commission books to be written about him. Jesus never had any books commissioned to be written about him. Rather, his followers wanted to make sure everybody knew about him, so they began to write stories like the one we have here in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, which have now been the number one bestseller year after year for 2 millennia straight. It is not even included in the New York Times bestseller to include the Bible because, once again, it's just not fair. On top of that, education has been so shaped by the desire of his followers to have people be able to read the words that he said that education has swept. All the great universities around the world all began as institutions that teach people to learn so they could teach people about Jesus. The stuff that he taught, which is in those books, has shaped everything about our humanity. The fact that he would teach, whatever you do for the least of these, you do it for me, is the very thing that started hospitals all around the world because people saw the suffering anywhere was a need that we had to meet. Why? Because Jesus says, meet this need in my name. Loving your enemies was not considered a virtue by any means. As a matter of fact, friends were created because they hated the same people that you hated. Yet Jesus says, love your enemies, and it's now become a virtue to forgive. It's actually become a beautiful thing to forgive simply because this is what he has taught. When it comes to how you lead change in a country, Jesus had a great influence on Leo Tolstoy, who had an influence on Mahatma Gandhi, who had an influence on Martin Luther King Jr. And you look at the civil rights movement, even within our own country, it traces all of itself, whether you want to deny it or not, back to the man, Jesus Christ, because anywhere that he is present, there is an influence for God, because God is going to influence the world through his son, and the people who are connected to him have an influence everywhere they go. There has been a spread of his name throughout the world, which cannot be stopped. The quotes about him from historians, regardless of what anyone may personally say or think about him, Jesus of Nazareth has been the dominant figure in history of Western culture for now almost 20 centuries. If it were possible with some sort of super magnet to pull up every scrap of metal bearing at least a trace of his name, how much metal would actually be left upon the earth? In some ways, the biggest challenge in gauging his influence is simply that we take for granted so many of the ways in which our world has been shaped by him. That was by a Yale historian. Ralph Waldo Emerson said this about him. He says, it's not so much that Jesus has tried to write his way into history as much as he has plowed his way through the history of the world. H.G. Wells marveled that after 2 millennia, a historian like himself, who doesn't even call himself a Christian, finds the picture that is centering irresistibly around the life and character of Christianity, the life and character of Jesus, being the most significant man in all of human history. Whatever you try to do, you cannot deny the influence that he has had. He has been a thermostat on the world. Anywhere his name has been spread, anywhere somebody has emulated him, anywhere somebody has sought to lift him up. And whenever his name is denied, they simply become a reflection of their culture. So what does that say for us as a church? If we are going to have an influence in our world, if we are going to do anything to be a thermostat rather than a thermometer, it's only to the extent to which we no longer be conformed to the world around us, but be transformed by the renewing of our mind to offer our bodies as a living sacrifice to become more like him. It's only to the extent at which we look to the local church, which God says is the hope of the world, which is the place where we would be the epicenter of his work, which is to be the embodiment of Jesus Christ, which is to be the body of Christ, the physical representation that when somebody would come in these walls, they would know what it's like to be around the man who has influenced all of human history more than any other. And only when we submit ourselves to that, we are filled with his spirit, which is his presence, which can live in us. When only we do that and we exude out the same kind of characteristics he had of love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, self-control. It's only when we do all of that that we can be an influence in our world. And so if you and I, as a church, as a people, are going to seek to change the world as God has planted in us, it's only going to be the extent to which we become like Christ and live among the people in our world and show Christ to them, not pointing out their sins, but becoming a training partner, becoming Christ amongst them, living out life with them, and taking Christ from the words that we read on the scriptures to deep within our soul to influencing the world around us. Would you join with me as we close?
Thank you for listening to the Essential Church Podcast. Let me encourage you to pause for a moment and reflect on what you've heard. It's not the hearing of the word, but the application that makes all the difference.